Greetings to all of God's people. This is again Mordecai Joseph. We're today in lesson 227 to 27. And let's continue with chapter 16 and verse 9 here. We were in this verse last time, in the last lesson. And we are with Israel. They're murmuring because they don't have food, they don't have drink. You know, every time they had a chance, they would murmur about it. That's how you know an Israelite, a person that constantly murmurs. And so, unfortunately, qualities that Israelites have probably more than any other nation on the face of the earth. A lot of people out there, you know, they are poverty-stricken, a lot of nations. They're used to hardships, and because of that, they have developed more patience, and they've got evil rulers. And so they're used to people abusing them, and therefore they develop certain qualities to cope with it. And murmuring was not a good idea in, under these circumstances for them, and so therefore they, you know, kept their mouth shut and just tried to live life without getting hurt. The Israelites were always very expressive, open-minded. You know, they became the people who were democratically oriented because, you know, they always speak up their mind. And so obviously with these kind of qualities, you go in that direction. And it's not always good, unfortunately, because if we are living our life with God, then we have to develop qualities that others, ironically, have an advantage over us because of their hardships in life. But the Israelites seem to be having a harder time developing these qualities of patience, of long-suffering, of willingness to put up with a lot of hardships in life without complaining, you see. And that's something for us to remember and consider what we're made of, what our weaknesses and the strength that the children of Israel have. And verse 9, Moses said unto Aaron, say unto all the congregation of the children of Israel, come near before the Lord, for he has heard your murmurings. Now, what does it mean, come near before the Lord? You see, in murmuring against God, they are in essence departing from God, going away from him, and not drawing near to him. And, you know, you read the statement many times, draw nigh unto God. In other words, draw near to God in your heart, in your mind, in your obedience, in your attitude. That's what he's telling them. Come closer and believe in God. Wait on him. Don't keep your distance there, because murmurings and complaining and bickering and all these things, you know, will create a distance between us and God. We are not near him. And so God is not near us because of that. And so this is what he's saying here. You come near before the Lord, for he heard your murmurings. I mean, he knows that you have needs, but he knows also that you need to learn a few lessons, and you are not willing to acknowledge that and to realize that, and just to put your trust in him, the one who did all these wonderful works for you all this time, and he did not lift a finger. So you have no reason to complain just because, you know, you've got some difficulties here and there. Just realize there is a purpose for it. Verse 10, and it came to pass, as Aaron spoke unto the whole congregation of the children of Israel, that they looked toward the wilderness. And in essence, they were coming before God, and God was going now to perform whatever miracle he was going to perform. And so they all look in that direction to see what God is going to do. And so they are. The look, and we read, and behold, the glory of the Lord appeared in the cloud. And where did it appear? Obviously, near the tent. There was a tent where God came and spoke to Moses, and that's before the tabernacle was put together. Sometimes, you know, we don't realize that there was a tent of meeting for Moses and Aaron, and there were even sacrifices offered there, and it was not yet the tabernacle itself. And that was sort of the type and the prototype that was there. And so long before they came to Sinai and received the law, and long before God gave the instructions about building the tabernacle, there was already one. It was sort of a temporary one. So Moses could come and speak to God face to face. And the Lord spoke unto Moses, saying, verse 11, I have heard the murmurings of the children of Israel, speak unto them, saying, at dusk you shall eat flesh, and in the morning you shall be filled with bread. And obviously, dusk does not mean darkness. because you know then you cannot see what you're doing. It has to be before, while you are still able to see and make things for what they are. In other words, see things for what they are. And so dusk does not mean darkness. It means, you know, toward the evening. And the word that he's using here again is the same one that he used for the Passover, Ben Harbaim. And we explained that concept, Ben Harbaim, the two evenings. And if you don't understand the Middle Eastern culture and the idioms and the language, you obviously would not know what it is. And because of that, a lot of people had a lot of difficulty understanding this terminology here. And they went to great length of inventing all kind of understanding for it. And they went on and on and on, writing articles, and some, you know, even wrote books about it. And all that is based on ignorance instead of simple, plain knowledge. Any Jew can tell you that from the Middle East. Any Arab in the Middle East can explain that to you very simply, not having the Holy Spirit. You don't need it for that. You have to understand the lingo, so to speak, of the nation, of the people, of the culture, to understand, you know, simple things like that. And so he said, Ben Harbaim, in the dusk, that means between the evening, it could be any time between 3 to 6, it could be even between 12 o'clock. In the middle of the day, when the sun begins to go down. You see, that was a terminology for the Passover, at the going down of the sun. Well, the sun begins to go down at 12. And at that time, more or less, begins the first evening, so to speak. Although this is the time when it's called the little sun, when it's still way up there. And then when it begins to go down, it gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and that's called the big sun. And so it was the little evening and the big evening. And then the space time between them, the time between them was called between the evenings, obviously. And that's when they offered the sacrifices later on in the temple. It didn't have to be in a specific time. It could be 2, it could be 3, it could be 4, it could be 5, you see. But obviously they did it at a time when the worshippers could come and pray and get out, and the sacrifices are over before darkness sets in, and nobody can see where they are going or what they are doing. And so this is what he's telling them. At dusk you shall eat flesh, and in the morning you shall be filled with bread. And you shall know that I am the Lord your God. And it came to pass at even. And so this is about Erev. It's not talking anymore about Ben Arbaim. It's not between the two evenings, which is a different time. But now it's toward the even. In other words, it was closer to the end of the day. And mind you, as we mentioned that before that, you know, you go to work in the morning, then you leave at 4 o'clock or 2 o'clock or 1 o'clock or 5 o'clock, and you say good evening to everybody. What do you mean good evening? You know, in summertime you have another 3 hours of sunlight, or 4 in some places. Well, it's again, it's a terminology, an idiom, a matter of culture, and that's basically, we have to understand it. There is a specific time and there is a general time, and that's basically what it is. And so it came to pass at even that the quails came up and covered the camp. So even means at a time where there was still light. It was toward the, you know, the literal evening, but not the real evening in terms of darkness. Otherwise, you don't see what you are doing there. And so around that time, any time after 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, that's when they came. That's what it meant in the evening. And obviously, that was easy for the Israelites to see them and capture them and cook them and do all that stuff and eat it, you know, right before dinner time. And it came to pass at even that the quails came up and covered the camp, and in the morning there was a layer of dew round about the camp. And when the layer of dew was gone up, behold, upon the face of the wilderness, a fine scale-like thing, fine as the hoarfrost on the ground. And when the children of Israel saw it, they said one to another, "What is it?" What is it means in Hebrew, manhu or mahu. And so they called it manna or man. And in other words, just what is it? Had no name for it, so they never gave a name for it. And basically it was just a question. And the question became the name of the item they were eating. What is it? What's that? For they knew not what it was. So I didn't know what kind of a name to give it. And Moses said unto them, "It is the bread." So Moses tells them what it is. It's bread. The bread from heaven, obviously, from God. "It is the bread which the Lord has given you to eat." This is the thing which the Lord has commanded. Gather you off it, every man according to his eating, and omer, a head, according to the number of your persons, shall you take of it, every man for them that are in his tent. So if you ten members in the family, you take ten portions of it, and don't be glutton. Don't take too much, don't take too little, just take a normal portion for a human being. And that teaches them also respect for others, don't be hoarding. A lot of people, you know, they go through the line and they fill up their plates, whatever it may be, and other people come behind, they've got nothing left. And that's in essence what the Apostle Paul is talking about with the Corinthians when they came, you know, for the night to be remembered. Those who came first, you know, were hoarding the food and eating and drinking, and those who came later had nothing, and they were ashamed. What are you going to do? Just stand there and there is no food, no wine, nothing. Obviously, that created a problem there, and that's what he told them about it. And mind you, that was the Passover night. They were coming to eat and to drink, and that's what he told them. You know, don't have food at home. You know, if you're so hungry, eat a little bit, or drink some wine before you come here, and don't be a glutton here and a wine beaver. Passover was a night to be remembered. It was the same night. Corinthians had no problem with that. The Jews had no problems with that. But people that came 2,000 years down the road, knowing nothing about those matters, began to argue about it. Endless debates and getting nowhere with it. And so he says, take as much as you need for each one of you and make sure that everybody has enough. Verse 17, and the children of Israel did so and gathered some more and some less, you know, depending on how much they needed, how many members in the family. And when they did meet it with an omer, he that gathered much had nothing over, and he that gathered little had no lack. So nobody went hungry. And nobody had too much. That's again the way God deals with us. He gives us based on our needs. And if it is for our desires also, we have to remember at the same time, if we've got more than we need, then we give to others who have a need. So the desires that He gives us is not just to consume on ourselves and be selfish and care nothing about others. When God blesses a person, it's not so he can, you know, eat everything and give nothing to his fellow man who is in need, but on the contrary, God gives him more to see and to test and to prove him. What are you going to do with it? Once you've eaten your steak, you know, you cannot eat five of them. What are you going to do with the rest? Going to share it with the poor? With the needy? You see? And people that do it, well, God continues to bless them. But the people that become selfish, well, when the time comes, God takes it away from them, even what they have. And so they are learning a lesson here. Just take what you need. And people are learning to hoard, and that becomes a human quality because of covetousness. And so they do also with everything else, and they develop those ungodly qualities instead of being godly, caring for everybody, making sure everybody's taken care of. And so when they went into the land, God told them to do the same thing. You know, depending on how many members you have in the family, that's going to be the size of your land that you're going to get. And depending on the size of the tribe, you know, all the households and things like that. And who's not just, you know, the first come, first served, and he gets the most, and then the rich get the most, and the powerful get the most, and the leaders get the most, you see, and they leave the crumbs, you know, for the poor. It doesn't work like that with God. You see, in a family, you don't behave like that. You don't sit around a table, and the father hoards, 90% of the food to himself, or the mother, or, you know, the elder brother, and all that. They make sure everybody has enough for what they need. And this is God's way. But we, you know, we departed from it, and we don't have it that way. And so you've got a lot of people, the minority, but there are too many. We've got too much. And there are the overwhelming majority who have too little. And for that reason, God is going to take everything from everybody. And He's going to redistribute that, again, among the people in the future. And each one is going to have just what they need. And it's not the kind of lens that we have today. You know, you sit in your room and you hear your next door neighbor. This is not what it means, what you need. You know, you need more space around you also. And that's what God means by that. Have plenty, have enough, so you're happy and comfortable, and so is your neighbor. And so this is one principle that God is teaching them also here. And everybody eats according to his eating, or gathers according to his eating. Verse 19, and Moses said unto them, let no man leave of it till the morning. In other words, gather only what you need and eat it, and that's it. In the morning you have some more, so you don't need to hoard. You know, this is the quality of slaves and poor people, and this is the quality of people who have been deprived. Without even realizing it, they begin to hoard. It's okay for animals to do it, you know, because winter is coming, so they didn't get it summertime. But they're not hoarding for the next summer, just for the next winter, that is, but, you know, only for the coming winter, and that's it. After that, they go out again and eat and gather. So verse 20, notwithstanding, they hearken not unto Moses. You see? Instructions didn't mean anything to them. The qualities of a slave were there. See, this is not the qualities of a king, of a royal son of God, of princes, of honorable people, of civilized people, of educated people, of people who care. You see, this is a quality of people who are, you know, in essence, you might say barbarians. A lot of people are acting like barbarians, and that's in essence what the rich and the powerful and the mighty, they're just a bunch of barbarians as far as God is concerned. They have no character. That's the reason why they're hoarding to themselves and impoverish all the rest. And so one person has $100 billion. What does he need $100 billion for? And they are money in abject poverty. You see? That's a wickedness in the sight of God. And regardless of all the excuses people, you know, can bring, you know, by saying that, you know, while he worked hard for it and things like that. That's no reason to have so much. When you work very hard, we should care about those who don't have any. That's our responsibility in life. And so these people would not listen. They were just hoarding. There was no need for it. But some of them, not all of them, but some of them left of it until the morning. And he bred worms and rotted. So there was no faith there. They didn't believe. And I thought, well, I got to have some for the morning just in case, you know, there isn't any, or whatever it may be. No faith whatsoever. And that's in essence the reason. When people trust in God, wait on God, they don't need to hoard, you see, like some people were doing during the Y2K. They were putting their trust in material things, in physical things. In essence, you see what happened after that. God makes, you know, in essence, God allowed us to reap the results. People now didn't know what to do with it after that. Because the trust and faith was not in God, and they went over and above and beyond. We're not talking about wisdom, using wisdom and discretion in matters like that. But a lot of people just allowed, you know, those qualities of covetousness, you know, of hoarding and deprivation and all these things, and thinking there isn't going to be any there, just to get the best of them. And they were, you know, in a sense, exposing themselves for what they are, and they let God know what they are made of. And they're going to have to learn lessons in the future. You got to trust in God. Put your faith in God. God is going to take care of our needs. We don't need to be hoarding all the time and take it away from others. Verse 21, and they gathered it morning by morning, every man according to his eating, and as the sun waxed hot, it melted. So that was not the time to fix, you know, to pick it up. Just as much as you need, and after that, forget about it. Tomorrow God will take care of us. As Christ would put it, sufficient unto the days are the worries thereof. Verse 22, and it came to pass that on the sixth day they gathered twice as much bread, because that's when God told them, that's what you do, because next tomorrow is the Sabbath. 2 omers for each one, and all the rulers of the congregation came and told Moses. And he said unto them, this is that which the Lord has spoken. So they wanted to know, why do we gather two days? You know, what's going to happen to it? You know, before that it spoiled. And so this is what Moses is explaining to them. This is what the Lord has spoken. Tomorrow is a solemn rest. It's a Sabbath. It's a holy Sabbath unto the Lord. Bake that which you will bake. That's when the day of preparation began, the concept of it. It's on Friday. And seethe that which you will seethe. In other words, meat, you know, you cook the meat, you boil, you know, whatever it may be. Do the heavy work, in other words, on Friday, on the day of preparation. And all that remains over, lay up for you to be kept until the morning. And they laid it up till the morning, as Moses bade, and it did not rot, neither was there any worm therein. Because why? Because God was the one behind it, preserving it. Every day it did not. So it was a lesson in faith every Sabbath day that they had to learn. And they saw that miracle every Sabbath day. Had it been any other day, that miracle would not have happened. So God made it very plain. When is the Sabbath day? And when it is not. And so for people kind of later on to come on, you know, with Sunday, or other people come with Friday, You know, obviously, they are not reading the scriptures and don't believe in them, and they go about inventing their own things. And so God makes it very plain. Even through a sign and a wonder and a miracle, for 40 years, He made it very plain which day is the Sabbath day. So nobody gets mixed up about it. Some people say, well, you know, maybe we lost count of the Sabbath. Well, God preserved it even by miracles for 40 days. Now, that is 40 years. Israel certainly never lost count of the Sabbath. They just, part of them, later on, invented their own day of rest. And they did not use the Bible for that, but their own reasoning. And they laid it up until the morning, as Moses bade, and it did not rot, neither was there any worm therein. And Moses told them, in verse 25, he said, eat that today, for today is a Sabbath unto the Lord. Today you shall not find it in the field. Again, lesson of test, every single week. Anybody who ever tried later on, you know, didn't find any. And so he told them in verse 26, 6 days you shall gather it, but on the seventh day is the Sabbath. He's repeating it several times, so nobody gets mixed up. In it there shall be none. Now forget about it. There isn't going to be any there. God's not working on the Sabbath. And it came to pass on the seventh day that there went out some of the people to gather. Now always those people who do not listen, don't believe. And maybe they, you know, many of them were strangers, and they would be also Israelites. There's people that no matter what you do, what instructions you give them, you know, they want to be unique. Okay, they are, you know, their own, you know, men, so to speak. Well, I'm doing my own thinking, you know, nobody's going to tell me what to do. That type of people, you always see them around. Individualistic. That's not safe. And they found none, and the Lord said unto Moses, how long refuse you, speaking about Israel, to keep my commandments and my laws? You see, he's giving them all kind of commandments, all kind of laws, all kind of teachings. And he gave them many before that, that were being passed on from generation to generation, and they were not paying attention. And so he's talking about this and about all the others. You see, you're just not listening. See, that the Lord has given you the Sabbath, therefore He gives you on the sixth day the bread of 2 days. Abide you every man in his place. Let no man go out of his place on the seventh day. So the people rested on the seventh day. You know, they are slaves in the habit of going, you know, to work every day. And they cannot break that habit. They're not even thinking about it. They're not listening to instructions. They're not trying to comprehend the meaning of the day. And how important it is, and it is from God, and it is for their own benefit. You know, the Sabbath was made for men, as we read later on in the New Testament, and not men for the Sabbath. And so that's what God was trying to explain to them. You know, He's a God of love, and He gave them a law of love. And some people are not paying attention to it, and to this very day, they're saying, well, I got to get busy, 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 you know, all the time. I can never rest, you know, I've got all those things to do. And the laws of God become meaningless to them. And verse 31, and the house of Israel called the name thereof Manna. In other words, the man was called Manna. And it was, Manna again comes from the word man, or what is it? You see, so they called it in essence Manna, which comes from the word what is it? So that became the name of it, Manna. And it was like a coriander seed, white, with the taste of it was like wafers made with honey. So it was a delicious food that God gave them, didn't give them tasteless food. And they should not have complained about it, but they did, like anything else. Verse 32, and Moses said, this is the thing which the Lord has commanded, let an omer full of it be kept throughout your generations. So here they take an omer, they put it in a jar, and they put it in the tabernacle, and for all these years, and we don't know how long it was there, it never spoiled. So that was a perpetual miracle that they could have, of course, you know, not everybody could go to the Holy of Holies and see it, because that was in the ark, but it was there. It never rotted. And God preserved it as a symbol, a spiritual symbol, until the one that came, that told them, he is the representation, the epitome of that manna, of that man, of that what is it. You see? He's the one that really gives them life. And after that, obviously, that thing disappeared. Nobody knows what happened to it. And so this is what he says. You're going to keep it. Let an omer full of it be kept throughout your generations, that they may see the bread wherewith I fed you in the wilderness. So apparently there was a way of seeing it, one way or the other, and the high priest or a priest or whatever it may be. It was a testimony for them for generations to come. So he said, so you will know that I fed you in the wilderness when I brought you forth from the land of Egypt. And Moses said unto Aaron, take a jar and put an omer full of manna therein and lay it up before the Lord to be kept throughout your generations. And so it ended up in the tabernacle. After that, they put it in the temple. And the Lord commanded Moses, so Aaron laid it up before the testimony to be kept, and the children of Israel did eat the manna 40 years until they came to a land inhabited. They did eat the manna until they came unto the borders of the land of Canaan. And that's not talking about the fact that, you know, when they came to the eastern part of the Jordan River, because they lived there for many years, they conquered territories there, you know, they went to war. This is not what it's talking about. Until they crossed the river Jordan, because they got to the borders of Canaan long before that. And so now we read in verse 36, now an omer is the tenth part of the ephah. So this is the measure of it. And when the children of Israel reached the borders of Canaan, again, it's the borders of Canaan, not the borders of Palestine, that miracle stopped, because now they had no need for it. Verse 17, and all the congregation of the children of Israel, we read in verse 1, journeyed from the wilderness of Sin. And that was the name of the desert. Again, no relationship to the English word Sin. By their stages. In other words, they traveled, and then they stopped, and they traveled again, and so they were advancing at a pace. And so that's the way they were going around. And so they did it according to the commandments of the Lord and encamped in Rephidim. Now Rephidim is an important place in the history of Israel. Soon we're going to read about it. And there was no water for the people to drink. So by now they've had the miracle of the quail and the miracle of the manna every day. And you would think, well, no problem. You know, we needed food, God gave it to us. And now we need water, and God is going to give it to us. No problem, you see. But obviously they don't think that way. Nothing ever taught them a lesson. A lot of people are that way. Carnal-minded people are that way. And all of us as parents know that our children are also that way. You can do all kind of good things for them, but as long as, you know, as soon as you say no to something, they begin to gripe and complain, totally forget all the good things that you've done for them, they think you don't like them anymore. And they grow that way, and some of them even into their late teenage and 20s and so forth. That's, you know, a quality of human nature, unfortunately. And we must learn to get rid of that. Totally uproot it from us. That even when we hear no from God, even then, not gripe and complain and bicker about it, but still say, thank you. Because I know that by telling me no, it's for my own good. Even though I may not see it at the time, and I may be, you know, sort of unhappy about it, and, you know, I wish I had it. But I'll give you thanks when you say yes and when you say no. And it's a lesson that we are learning here. Now, these people of Israel, our forefathers, never learned it. And many people in our midst to this very day still never learn it. God takes care of our needs. Whatever we need, He will take care of it. But if He sees that we need to learn a lesson, He's going to withhold it for a little while. And the sooner we develop that nature, that quality of God, of faith, of trust and all that, you know, the sooner we're going to get what we need. And we're just going to have to wait for that. And in the process, we should be thankful to God that, you know, we're giving an opportunity to learn a quality which we don't have. Because these are our true riches that we can carry with us, and the only things we can carry with us into eternity. No physical things can be taken with us. And so God, as long as they had needs in the wilderness, He gave them those things. And as soon as they reached the border of Canaan, well, there was no need there, and so God stopped giving it to them. What does that mean? From now on they start complaining, they don't get it anymore? No, God says now you can go and do whatever you can do, you know, with your own hands. And when we can do things with our own hands, we should not go to God and ask for it. Now, a lot of people, you know, tell God when they lose a job, when they need a job, well, please, God, give me a job, you know, and they pray every morning and night and whatever it may be, and they do nothing about it. And God doesn't give them a job. It's not His business to give us a job. Now, if we have no job and we're looking for it, and our, you know, family is hungry and we are in terrible need of it, God opens doors for us, but He's not going to walk through it. We have to do it ourselves, so we have to do the footwork. And, you know, we develop this kind of relationship with God, then we don't worry in life. You know, even when we have lacks in life, we said, okay, you know, sometimes you need to go to bed hungry. You're not going to die. That's what the apostles have done, the prophets of God. When God did not provide for them, they went to bed hungry. That's what Paul was saying. You know, I've learned to be content in every situation that I was. I didn't have to have my way all the time. I didn't have to have my needs fulfilled all the time. Sometimes I can go without needs being fulfilled. And so he went to bed hungry. And he didn't complain about it. You know, he would sing to God and praise God and thank God, you know, for all that, all the good things that he does for him. And this too was a good thing, because sometimes you need to learn how it feels to go hungry and what people go through when they have no food. And so that's the way God deals with us. Well, these people have never learned that. And the question is, you know, for all of us to ask, you know, are we learning that? Are we learning to go without needs, even when they are, you know, very, very important to us at the moment? And just, you know, say, okay, you know, I can go through that. You know, just like when you fast, you deprive yourself. You're doing it willingly. So, you know, when needs are not given to us because God doesn't choose to fulfill them, we should be willing to go along with it. And say, okay, well, you know, for the joy that is ahead of me, I'm willing to suffer. I'm willing to take, you know, this affliction and go on. And ultimately, you know, obviously, God will take care of me, because He's not interested in tormenting me or torturing me, and that's not the point. Some people think that's what it is. You know, you tell a kid you're not going to eat, you know, for 3 hours, and you think, you know, you're trying to torment and kill them and torture them. And we must not be children when it comes to these matters, but adults. And so these people are complaining. Verse 2, wherefore the people strove with Moses. That's the first thing they do. Poor Moses, you know, for 40 years had to put up with them. And they said, give us water that we may drink. You know, there's no supermarket there, no grocery stores, no vending stands and all that. And they come to Moses and say, give us water. If they had faith, they would pray to God. They don't even need to go to Moses. Go to God and say, well, God, you know, we have needs. We're human beings, flesh and blood. Our children are crying. Have mercy on us. We trust in you and wait on you. And we thank you that you heard us. And God will do it for them. After all, He made it very plain all this time that He was doing it for them in so many ways. Well, instead of that, they go and begin to complain. Give us, you know, to drink. And of all things, they go to a man. And people always go to government. You know, we want this and we want that and we want everything else. I think government is God. And politicians, based on that, you know, begin to lie and tell all kinds of stories because they know they've got nothing to give, oftentimes. And so they just make empty promises which they cannot keep, so they can get elected. Well, that's human nature. So we get what we deserve. And so these people go to a man instead of going to God. No relationship. They're not developing a relationship. And for us, it's the same thing. Are we developing a relationship? Are we complaining always to people about this and that and the other thing? Instead of walking with God, trusting in God, you see, and if need be to go to people, do it, you know, with the right attitude. And thankful attitude, with thanksgiving, with supplication and thanksgiving, not murmuring and bickering and saying, you know, what's wrong with you? And so Moses said unto them, why do you strive with me? You know, I haven't got a grocery store, what do you come to me for? Wherefore do you try the Lord? You know, that's in essence what you're doing when you strive with me. You're testing the Lord. You're saying in essence, well, God cannot do it, so we're not going to even to pray to Him or ask Him or plead with Him or trust in Him. And the people thirsted there for water. And the people murmured against Moses and said, and that became a favorite saying for them. Anytime they didn't get their way, they used this statement against Moses. And they said to Moses, wherefore have you, you know, you are the guilty one, not God. They complained to Him, and they don't realize when you complain to Him about these matters, and He had nothing to do with it, God is the one, you're complaining against God. And a lot of us, oftentimes, when we complain about this and the other thing, it never dawns on us. Maybe God is the one involved in it. You see? And if we complain about those matters, we're complaining against God. And so it says, They said to him, "Why did you bring us forth out of Egypt to kill us and our children and our cattle with thirst?" Now this is malice on their part. This is a wicked heart. And how many times, you know, we impute evil to others. And what you've done, whichever it may be, you know, in our mind, it's because you hate me. We don't get all the facts. We don't ask questions. We don't try to find out what's really behind it. What's the reason? Maybe it's a good reason. Maybe it's something that, you know, we should say, okay, you know, I'm willing to put up with it. We immediately begin to accuse. You know, that's the spirit that comes from Satan, you know, the spirit of the accuser. And that's what they're doing here. And so they're accusing Moses, and they tell him that, in essence, you brought us here into the wilderness in order to kill us and our cattle with thirst. Now, was it true? Obviously not. And so, in doing so, they, in essence, were first accusing him, imputing motives where there were none, and that's evil to begin with, and then they were lying about it. Since this is not what was on his mind, this isn't what he did, so in saying that this is what he did, they're, in essence, telling a lie. And that's not true. That's in essence what happens, you know, when we complain about things we do not understand. We impute motives, and then by saying certain things that people have done which they haven't done, we are in essence bearing a false witness. And we have to learn not to be this kind of people, to depart from that, and that's the only way Christ is going to be formed in us, when His laws, when His teachings, when His commandments, that to begin with we have to study and not say, well, that's not done, you know, done away with, you know, I just go by grace and faith. When those things are becoming a part of us, that's how Christ is being formed in us. There is no other way. Without the law of God, there is no other way for Christ to be formed in us. And a lot of people don't understand it. You know, they just go for the ethereal teachings. You know, just think sweet, nicey, nice thoughts, and behave yourself, and you're in Christ. Well, it doesn't work like that. That's why Christ said, you know, men shall live by every, you see, life that is being formed in us, the eternal life that is given to us, happens when we live by every, not some, not few, not most, every word of God. You see, every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God, that's in essence what Christ is telling us. That's how you are going to have life. You see, and He said, "My word is spirit." And if we're going to become spirit beings and have this kind of life and live for eternity, every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God that God wants us to keep, obviously there are certain laws based on circumstances we cannot keep, but every law that God wants us to keep and we can keep must become a reality in our life, a part of our nature. And the main thing that we have to work on is our attitude, obviously. And then you've got all the others in between, and the small ones and the big ones. And so Moses cries in verse 4, Moses cried unto the Lord saying, "What shall I do unto this people? They're almost ready to stone me." That's how far they went. "We have needs. You're guilty that we don't have them. You want to kill us? We're going to stone you." And that's how people act, you know, oftentimes. That's why people go on strike. You know, they don't get what they want. "Well, I'm going to go on strike." And some of them become violent. And some of them, you know, something didn't go right in the office. And come back with a gun and they shoot the supervisor or the manager or whatever it may be. A lot of people like to do it just, you know, they don't want to go that far with a weapon, so they do it with the weapon of their tongue. And how many of us may be guilty of that? That's the spirit of murder. So this is what happened to the children of Israel. We start with those things, and we have to ask ourselves, looking in the mirror, am I that type of a person? When my needs are denied, be it within the family, you know, between a husband and wife, people say, "Well, you know, you're denying my needs. I hate you for it. I'm going to speak evil, you know, against you. I'm going to impute motives to you. I'm going to hold it against you." You see, especially in this country of freedom, people think they deserve everything, and we owe them everything. And especially children, you know, they are taught that kind of life. Unfortunately, the whole world owes them a living, and they think they deserve it. And you don't give it to them, and they hate you for it, and speak evil of you. And some get violent, and there are people, you know, there are children who kill their parents. Shoot their parents because they didn't get what they want, or they shoot the teacher, or whatever it may be. You see, that nature is in all of us, and we're not careful. It's going to get the best of us here and there without even realizing it. We have to come to the point like Jesus Christ, where He says, "The prince of this world comes, and he has nothing in me." We must be the same. become like Jesus Christ, where there is absolutely nothing of the devil in us, of his nature, because he was our former father. And it certainly taught us very well to be like him. You know, he was, in essence, ironically speaking, a good parent. Gave us good child rearing. Very effective. Verse 5, and the Lord said unto Moses, pass on before the people, and take with you the elders of Israel, and your rod, wherewith you smote the river. So now not Moses doing it with a rod, but he takes all the leaders of Israel. And your rod, wherewith you smote the river, take in your hand and go. Behold, I will stand before you there upon the rock in Horeb, and that is still by near Mount Sinai. And you shall smite the rock. And mind you, we're still in chapter 17. That's two chapters before they receive the law in chapter 20. But they're already in that vicinity of Sin, the wilderness of Sin, and Mount Sinai is right there. So they're right by the mountain. And it is, you know, if you have here a symbolic act in essence here that has a spiritual connotation from Mount Horeb, and Horeb means, in essence, desolate. You see, dead, no water in it. Out of death, God is going to bring life. Out of death, there is going to be resurrection. Out of dead people, dead in sins, God is going to give them life if they obey Him. And He is that life. He is the water. You see? And when people are that kind of people, then that water is going to be lodged in them, and then out of their own belly, as Christ would say later on, he that believes in me, out of his belly, he didn't say out of mine, but out of his belly shall, you know, flow rivers of living waters. Once we internalize the law of God, which is spirit and which is a drink and food, then it's going to come out of us and feed others. And so this is what's happening here in essence. And so I said, you stand on the rock in Horeb, that's Mount Sinai, and you shall smite the rock, and there shall come water out of it, so that the people may drink. And Moses did so in the sight of the elders of Israel, so there are witnesses that saw it, and passed on that information to the rest of the people of Israel, and the people of Israel passed it on to their children, and so it is to this very day. And now we have the record here that we can read it, if you never heard about it before. And the name of the place was called Massah. And Massah means strife or trying. From that comes the word lenasot in Hebrew, to try or to tempt. As it was translated in English, which is not a correct one, it's not to tempt. You see, it's to try. Just like you try a car, you know, before you buy it. And so it was called Massah. And Meribah means strife. Massah means to try. And they were, in other words, they were having a strife with God and having a strife with Moses. And so God gave that very place that name, Massah and Meribah, because of the striving of the children of Israel and because they tried the Lord. See, they were trying God to see, well, can you really do that? Are you going to do it? You know, with imputing motives, evil heart, wicked thoughts. You see a lot of people around, you know, us like that. When they talk about God in terms of their needs, when their needs are not being met, they are not doing it with a spirit of humility and meekness, but with a sort of malicious attitude. You know, and that's in essence often time when they put forth that question. Well, why did Johnny died? You know, if God is a God of love, you know, that is, if God, what even if God is a God of love? And how many of us are getting into that attitude too? You know, when bad things happen to us. And we have to be careful to mind our, you know, thoughts and feelings and see where they come from. And so they were trying God. Imagine that, to try God. Saying, is the Lord among us or not? And what kind of a question is that? He's right there, feeding you every day. You eat the manna in the morning. You eat the quail. All the signs and wonders and miracles. Your clothes are not getting old. You are not wearing out. Miracle after miracle, day and night. And you're still saying, is God among us or not? You say, what kind of a nature produces this kind of questions? But an evil, evil nature. And that's what God, in essence, tells all of us. That's what Christ told the disciples. You being evil, know how to give good gifts. How much more your Father? I have to recognize that. We are evil. There is evil in us. There is evil in all of us to one degree or the other. That's why we have selfishness and malice and imputing motives and complaining and bickering and you know, and all the things that we do. That evil is in us. We're sick people. We need a physician. We have to realize that at all times. Never pretend and think that we are perfect people, good people, nice people. We are not. Until all the poison is totally taken out of us, we're going to be evil to that degree. And so, this is what they're doing here. Well, anyway, we're going to stop at this point again. This is Mordecai Joseph. Greetings to all of God's people.